You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Mammal Watching podcast with me, John Hall from New York.
And me, Charles Foley in Minneapolis.
Welcome home, Charles. I know you were just in Spain. Did you have a chance to see any mammals?
Well, I had high hopes for wafting off to Andújar and looking for lynx and that sort of thing. But in the end, I had no time at all to do any of that sort of fun stuff. But I was based in the south of Spain, so near the Montes de Málaga. And on a couple of days, I took an afternoon off and went just driving up through the hills. And there's a surprising amount of wildlife up there. My favorite is always the Spanish ibex, which is just a beautiful animal, beautiful goat with lovely black markings on its legs, etc. So saw quite a few of those and some roe deer, which were new to me for that part of Spain, and wild boar and some of the other more common things like red fox and the Spanish hare and lots of rabbits. So didn't do too badly, but unfortunately didn't quite make it up to the lynx place.
No, I'm sorry you didn't get there, but it is such a great country for wildlife. I mean, such a great country for everything, but for wildlife, there's a lot there to see. Yeah.
But now you are just about to take off to Chile and then Argentina. So what are you hunting for over there?
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. Chile, I'm going to be working remotely for a couple of days on Chiloé Island. So my main goal there would be to see the cod, the little cat, which isn't common at all, but there's a chance. I'd like to see Pudu again, that little deer that's there. I saw it last time, but I'd like to see it better.
Yeah.
And then thanks to you, Charles, and your introductions, I'm going up to meet some researchers who are working on Monito del Monte, the grandmother of all marsupials. So I'm hoping we'll get that one in Chile. And then off to Argentina for a week, and a childhood friend of mine, I've known him since he was six, is coming over. And he's not a mammal watcher, but he likes these trips occasionally to get out of his comfort zone and have a bit of fun. So we're going to be focusing on the Buenos Aires province, which is the big kind of bulge south of Buenos Aires. And some of the targets there are things like Franciscana or the La Plata dolphin, which is in a family of its own. Lutrine opossum, which is a relative of the water opossum.
Oh, right.
Which I think is pretty uncommon, but the guide we're going with has seen one at least once before. There's a couple of armadillos, and I'm sure there'll be a few rats and bats we can look for, as well as some pretty good food and wine. So it's going to be, I hope, a lovely couple of weeks. And then I'm coming to see you, the highlight, of course.
Well, that sounds absolutely fantastic. That sounds like a great trip. Best of luck, John. And
thank you.
I look forward to you updating all of us when you get back.
Yep, I do too. I hope I have good news to share.
Well, our guest today is Connor Bergin. Connor is a PhD student working on mammalian systematics at the University of New Mexico and working with the Museum of Southwestern Biology. He is the taxonomic curator of the Mammal Diversity Database, which is hosted by the American Society of Mammalogists. Connor also worked with the publishing company Lynx Editions to write 6 volumes of mammalian compendia. His interests lie in mammalian taxonomy, speciation, and general systematics, and he is a major advocate for the use of museum collections in species conservation and research. Over the years, he has carried out fieldwork in the US, Canada, Panama, and Ecuador to build museum collections and to document mammalian biodiversity in these regions. Connor, welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here. Very excited to be here. Love your podcast.
Well, thank you, Connor. We're really happy to have you here. It's very exciting to talk to you. An expert on taxonomy is just what we need.
It is indeed.
Thank you.
So can you start, Connor, by telling us how you got interested in wildlife? What's the story?
It's honestly just like any naturalist, really. Everyone started looking at like animals when they were young, went on hikes, yada, 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 the general story. For me, it was honestly an obsession with making lists that did it. When I was little, I was obsessed with dinosaurs, and I liked to go on Wikipedia and just search through the list of dinosaurs that existed. And then when I was 12, I realized I kind of liked living things because you were able to actually go and observe these animals in real life. And mammals it's kind of stupid, or the easiest ones for me to make a list of. And I did that when I was 12. It's a very stupid way to have gotten into wildlife, but it kind of fueled this passion for taxonomy that I had because I was making a list of mammals that didn't exist at the time. The only thing that existed was Wilson and Reeder's online checklist, which was not updatable. And back then, I saw a new species of elephant shrew that was described in 2008, which was Rhynchocygon udzungwensis, I think the species was. And back in 2010, I was doing a report in my history class, and I always made sure it was biology related because I didn't really care for the history when I was 12 years old. And I ended up doing this report on this new species, and I noticed that it wasn't listed anywhere. It wasn't on Wikipedia. I found it on what's that news reporting? Manga Bay?
Manga Bay.
Manga Bay. Yeah. And that was the main source of new species descriptions I would find at that time. And it was really exciting to me that new mammal species were being described because it was a group that I had thought was really well studied up until finding this new species discovery. And that started a Wikipedia binge, which eventually turned into me trying to find an updated list of all the world's mammals and noticing that there wasn't one. And that began my search for and the creation of a updatable taxonomic listing that I eventually would send to Don Wilson, who was the curator emeritus at the Smithsonian when I was around 15 years old. And he would put me in contact with Nate Upham later on to turn this list into what is currently the Mammal Diversity Database. But up until I was 18, I didn't have a lot of opportunities to actually meet with mammalogists and go and be in nature. Like, my family loved natural settings, but we were kind of poor. We didn't really have the money to go out and explore the world. So it wasn't until I was around 18 when I finally got the chance to go do field work after going to my first American Society mammalogist meeting, where I was able to go to Panama and eventually Ecuador, and then do field work in various places in the United States and more recently in Canada. But yeah, that's kind of my upbringing. It all started with a list, and now I get to actually do what I love to do.
So hold on one second. So the Mammal Diversity Database started from your childhood list. Is that
Yeah. And something funny about
what
it, to be honest, when I was 12, I was obsessed with Bigfoot. Don't believe in it
I'm
anymore, but I used to watch Finding Bigfoot. And there was a species description for Bigfoot, and I included it on my list. I thought it was so cool. Eventually, obviously, I took that off the list, but that name is now actually a synonym of, I think, one of the bear species because it was shown that the fur used as the holotype for that name came from a bear.
So what do you do now? What's your current job? I know you're doing a PhD, but you're also helping manage the diversity database. So what's your daily work look like?
It kind of varies. Throughout my PhD, I've gone back and forth between focusing more on the publications I've worked on with Links Editions and the Mammal Diversity Database, and more on my research for my thesis. I work with the Museum of Southwestern Biology, so we're having a lot of specimens that come in and that get cataloged into our records or our record system, our database called ArcDos. And then they get moved on into the collection. And fun fact about the museum, we actually get every Mexican gray wolf that dies in New Mexico sent to our museum. So we process a lot of wolves. So throughout my time in PhD, I've processed a lot of specimens that eventually end up in the museum to be cataloged holistically. So we're getting as much information data as possible from these specimens. And that's part of my job is collecting these specimens, collecting the data associated with them, the tissue samples, the skin, the skeleton, and then putting it into the museum. And another aspect is part of my research is molecular work. So I end up taking these tissues, such as some that are stored at the museum's Division of Genomic Resources. And we'll take those and sequence them in our lab setting, the Joe Cook Molecular Evolution and Ecology Lab. I have not had as much experience in that, so that is currently what I'm doing every day right now is getting that done. But in terms of the mammal diversity database, it's a constant updating system. I have a lot of Google Scholar alerts that I get all the time for every family of mammal. And then I have resources across the globe that are sending me papers pretty regularly as they come out, so I can make sure that I have an updated list of the world's mammals and their taxonomic resources.
So the next question I was getting, first of all, as I said before we started talking, I am possibly the number one fan of the Mammal Diversity Database. I seriously look at it every single day. I think it's wonderful. And I'd imagine there was a team of 100 people working on this. So I was going to ask how many people work on it, but it sounds like it's really just you. Is that right?
Currently, yeah.
That's incredible. You are an overachiever. So the genesis was your list, but how did it turn into this database? And I imagine there was funding and all sorts of things, but can you just tell us a bit more about how it actually works in practice?
Yeah, so I work with a guy who is currently, or a researcher who is out in Arizona State University. He was at Yale at the time as a postdoc, when we first were conceiving the idea of the Mammal Diversity Database, but his name is Nathan Upham. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who pulls all the shots. He's the funding source. He pulls all the people together to make sure this happens. And we were both at the time working independently to create a list of the world's mammals. And Don Wilson knew that I was creating this list independently and put me in contact with him when I was 18. So when I was just starting college, I got to meet up with Nate. Nate saw my list. My list was more comprehensive than the list that he had, but we put it together and made an even better, more cohesive list that ultimately became the first rendition of the Mammal Diversity Database. At this point, and since from that point on until now, we have mostly relied on me and a few other student workers to update the database. And I've been the person making taxonomic decisions for the database. And those taxonomic decisions generally are taken from the most recent taxonomic revision of any individual group that we're looking at, unless the paper that proposed a taxonomic change was just really bad. So if the data is really, really horrendous, or based on just very little data compared to what other resources are available for the taxonomy of that group, we won't follow it after discussion with our broader team, which includes about 6 or 7 people. And more recently, we've been trying to expand the database to more taxon, like foreign nomenclature based information. So synonyms of every name, and we have distribution for every species on there, at least to the country level currently. But we're trying to team up with other resources to make the distribution less coarse.
So effectively, you will scour the literature for published papers, and your basic assumption is that if the paper has passed the peer review process, which is a process by which it's sent out to other people in the field who make comments on it, and so long as it's passed that, then you accept that as valid, unless the paper seems to be really, really poor. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, and you'd be surprised how many papers go through that process that end up being really, really poor as well.
Right.
Yeah, imagine.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can pull out plenty of examples, but I don't really want to call out specific researchers and specific groups too much on here, because they potentially could be listening to us. So yeah. Don't want to start a fight.
Very wise.
Yes, indeed. And if there is a doubt, the final arbiters on this are who? Is it this group of 6?
Currently it is. However, we have plans to expand this to more people.
Right.
So right now, we have been relying on me as the sole person making taxonomic decisions within this group. And I don't want that pressure anymore. As much as this is a passion for me, I really love mammal taxonomy. I love being the person to combine all this information to one spot and have it as a resource for other mammalogists and other researchers. It is a lot. Like, I have had so many people ask me about the taxonomy of Canis and just how convoluted and terrible that genus is. And I'm just like, I'm doing the best that I can. And I would rather have a group of experts on that specific group making that decision rather than a single person making this decision. It does keep it consistent if it's a single person, which is an important aspect of any checklist. However, if we have a voting system and subcommittees, it'll allow for at least some sort of group consensus. And we would like to also include people from around the world too, rather than just making this an American-based taxonomic checklist. So we're putting a group of subcommittees together. We've been talking about it for like 2 years now, but it's a process because you have to get a lot of people to volunteer to be able to do this. And we want a system similar to what some of the ornithological communities have done for their own checklists.
Right. I mean, to be honest, I'm astonished that there is no single overarching arbiter on mammalian taxonomy. I find that really interesting. So this list is housed, managed under the auspices of the American Society of Mammalogists. I mean, you mentioned the Smithsonian and Don Wilson, etc. Do they also have their own lists? Are there other lists out there which are sort of running parallel to the ASM lists? How does that work?
Yeah, so there are, I mean, Smithsonian has its own separate list as well. I forgot the name of it off the top of my head, but they have lists for a bunch of different groups of vertebrates, but they're usually not up to date and they're based off of previous existing lists. Like the mammal list they have is based off of Wilson and Reeder 2005, which was the last major compendium before the current Handbook of the Mammals of the World series and the MDD. And then the IUCN also has a separate listing of its own that's based on subcommittees as well. Certain subcommittees have voted to use the MDD for upcoming assessments, including the Small Mammal Specialist Group, which Nate Upham is a part of. For small mammals, that's a pretty easy thing to do because small mammal taxonomy is a lot less controversial than a lot of the other larger, more charismatic groups of mammals. So when we're just taking newer papers and using them for the taxonomic arrangements of small mammals, it's like it's the consensus for a lot of the groups or the groups of people studying those groups of organisms. Whereas primates, it's a little more complicated. Primates, large mammals in general, ungulates, carnivores, they all have their own specialist groups that haven't yet opted to use the MDD because they don't agree with using the most recent taxonomic revisions. A lot of the time, they're either more conservative or less conservative than the MDD is. And on top of this, the MDD is actually working with another mammal taxonomic database that came into the light in the past 2 years called Hesperomys. Hesperomys is run by somebody very similar to me, Yella Zylstra, I think. Yeah, that's his name. He, very eccentric person, loves mammal nomenclature and taxonomy as well. But our two databases had different purposes. For the MDD, we kept track of species designations and distributions and more and conservation status as well. Whereas Hesperomys came up as a nomenclature database, so it keeps track of every name applied to every mammal living and extinct, and it's expanded past that as well. And we've recently combined forces where they're using our taxonomy and we're using some of their nomenclatural data, which the nomenclature is just the names used and who named them, what the holotype is. And ultimately, these are strengthening the two databases as we, especially as we expand the MDD to be more comprehensive with regards to what information is included in it. But yeah. There are other lists. They're just different at this point.
I think perhaps it's worth mentioning that because people would think, well, there's only a sort of defined number of species out there, etc. But the whole point is that the whole concept of what a species is as yet not fully defined. So two animals, they interbreed in some areas, but at the edges, they look different. They could potentially be one species. They could be split into two species. They could be split into more, four or five. So it really depends on what definitions you're using.
Yeah. And talking about species concept is always fun. It's the easiest way to get into a fight at any biology meeting. But yeah, the MDD, we try to avoid making objective decisions based on our own species concept by following the most recent taxonomic revisions, which the MDD shows a consensus of the mammalogical community in terms of what species concepts are being implemented to make taxonomic decisions in the peer-reviewed literature. But one of my chapters of my thesis is actually investigating how consistently we have attributed species concepts across the mammalian phylogeny. So if we look at ungulates versus rodents, we're going to see that those two groups have very different species concepts being applied to them, at least within modern taxonomy, depending on which taxonomy you use. Because if you were to use something, I'm not sure if you guys are aware of the Groves and Grubbs taxonomy
Oh,
from
yes.
2011, that shook up the ungulate taxonomy, and the MDD actually followed that for the first rendition, and we went back on that after a bit once we decided to make more objective decisions on taxonomies that are less supported or not supported by other literature.
Right. And perhaps just to like summarize a little bit over there, Groves and Grubb came up with a new taxonomy for ungulates. They've sort of blown the field apart. And the one that really stood out for me was a clip springer, where it went from one species to 11 species. And I think it's fair to say that there was a substantial backlash in the both scientific community, but also in the conservation world, because the problem is governments have to make decisions on species protections and protection plans, et cetera, based on the name of that species. And if all of a sudden they thought they were protecting one species and they find out that it's now five, that can seriously complicate matters. So there are all sorts of ramifications for this splitting of species. So personally, I'm glad to hear that you went back to the more conservative approach than the Groves and Grubb. But again, that's just me.
Yeah, it's definitely a very opinion-based taxonomic decision. And Groves and Grubbs based that decision primarily off of morphological data. And even when, I mean, for a lot of these groups, they only had single individuals to base this entire taxonomic decision based on or taxonomic change on. And clip springers, for example, that was a pretty rough chapter. And deer, just the entire cervid family was split up in all sorts of ways. And he also split Cecrophora, the Eurasian boar, into a bunch of species very haphazardly. And there was just a lot of confusion on what was and wasn't recognized as a species in this large book as well. It was a hard one to go back on because in the Handbook of the Mammals of the World, they included that taxonomy just for Bovidae, which that put a huge wrench in how we made decisions for the MDD because it was a very large compendia and it popularized this major taxonomic change. So a lot more people started using it for various different publications and conservation resources. But yeah, the ramifications for that taxonomic change were pretty big, and I'm glad we went back to a more conservative taxonomy.
And the latest checklist from the Handbook of the Mammals of the World has actually gone back on it as well now, so it's following the MDD. So yeah, they've
Which
stepped
is
back from it too. I just as you said, this is I mean, biologists, can get into a fight about this at parties, but the mammal watching community also gets very hot under the collar about taxonomy, and they'll start complaining to me about why have I done this on my list, and I just point them towards you and say, no, I just follow the MDD. I'm not an expert. So you've got a big responsibility to carry. But they also talk, the birding world, which of course there's far more many bird watchers and they're much more argumentative than us nice mammal watchers, they seem to be fighting perpetually about this. How do they organize themselves,
The bird people?
in terms of their list? I mean, I know there's several lists, but how do they make decisions?
There are three different major lists,
Right.
and they don't. They haven't communicated, from what I've understood, very well because they have very different taxonomic or species concept opinions. But I recently talked to Nate, and I had a meeting with some people, Steve Garnett, I think his name is, who are trying to make a global list of all life, and they're considering using the MDD for the mammal list portion of that. And they've apparently talked to the bird people about making a consensus list, where all three taxonomic groups are talking to each other now. I don't know how well that's going. I know that they're going to do their best, but it would be really nice to see a consensus list. However, I'm kind of split on the idea of whether there should be a single list for any group, actually. As much as I run the MDD, and I think that it's a good resource for people to find this taxonomic data, I think there should be room for disagreement in species concepts and taxonomic opinions, because this is much more of an opinion-based science than it is a data-based, because you can have the same data and analyze it in two different ways. So I think that even within the mammal community, there should be multiple lists that are making different taxonomic decisions. However, I don't think that we've come to that place yet, in the same way the bird people have, which has been spurred a lot by a more generalized interest in birds, which is sad to me, obviously, because I love my mammals, but bird people, they have the numbers, and they're easier to see. So
yeah, it strikes me that there's an argument for having different lists for different purposes. So as Charles is saying, the conservation is one purpose, and that might require a different way to look at the world compared to mammal listing, or the, you know, whatever other reasons people use the taxonomy for. But it's a fascinating question. And the next fascinating question, which I also get a lot of grief about, is domestic species. And so the MDD includes a bunch of domestic species. Why is the question I'm asked very often. And do you only include domestics, what we call domestic species that are living wild or feral, or do you include all domestic species? And what's the rationale?
There is a lot of gray area with this one. I want to preface that with that statement. This is a decision we decided more for conservation purposes than for taxonomy. And I get a lot of flack for it as well. I actually don't agree that they're separate species. They really aren't in almost every case, at least in terms of the species concepts we use. We generally include domestic taxa that are well listed, if that makes sense. They've been included in a lot of checklists separately. And it provides a name that's usable for the domestic form and for the wild form. And the reason why that is important, for us at least, is that provides two different names to talk about two different situations. One is talking about a species that may be endangered, and then the other is talking about livestock. Again, this is something that we've actually gone back and forth on, about whether or not we want to continue doing that or not. I personally don't care to do it. However, on a conservation standpoint, I've had people give me flack for both directions at this point. So I maintain the domestic taxa. I think we include ones that are generally included as distinct taxa in checklists that from throughout the ages. An example of a taxa that we removed recently, because I don't even know why we added it in the first place, was a domestic bentang. We removed that one recently because there hasn't been anywhere that actually includes it separately. It was listed as a distinct taxa within, I think, the illustrated checklist, and we continued it. And that was something that was an internal debate when I was working on the illustrated checklist of the mammals of the world as well. So again, there's a lot of gray area with this one, and I think that there's a lot more discussion that needs to be had on what type of domestic organisms we include as separate species, if we include them as separate species. Because currently the only one that I would include would be a dromedary camel, if we were going off of what is and isn't a legitimate species. Because like Canis familiaris is blatantly included under gray wolves, Canis lupus, genetically. But we talk about those two organisms very separately, at least in the literature and in terms of conservation. So it's a very up in the air type thing. And then the same thing would be said for if we include subspecies as well, like Cestogrypha, domesticus, including the subspecies domesticus. It's a paraphyletic taxon, no matter what, whether we include it as a subspecies or a species, or if we want to include variants of some kind, but we don't really do that in the animal world. That's more of a plant thing. So it's more of a convenience thing at the moment. But ultimately, we list the caveats of this on the MDD's About page, and we list that these are not biological species. They're species in the sense that we keep them separate for administrative use, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense. I'm just thinking about how many species I'm going to lose if you change your mind, which is, of course, the main thing you should be thinking about, too.
And do you see any particular mammal groups that you think are going to experience significant taxonomic revision in the future? Are there some that are just ripe for that?
I think ungulates. As much as we went back on groves and grubs taxonomy, I think ungulates are a group that is in dire need of taxonomic revision. For example, Klipspringer. I could bring up that example as a group that needs revision and also a group that was over-revised based on very little data. But what has been shown is that this group is morphologically plastic. There's a lot of genetic variation within this single genus. There's a lot more we could do to show whether it is a single species or if it is multiple species. But again, we need more data. And giraffes are a good example of this. Giraffes, there's a lot of debate as to how many species of giraffe there are at this point. The most authoritative revision on giraffes came out a few years back, and it used whole genomes to look at the population genetics between the different populations of currently living giraffe. And that resulted in four species being recognized, although some papers have claimed for three species. And there are some authorities that still only recognize a single species, despite all the data that's been thrown at this group. I'm personally leaning towards the four species, at least based on the literature that I've read. But again, these taxonomic decisions take a while to actually get into the conservation world. So the IUCN only recognizes a single species currently with a bunch of subspecies. And I think it'll be a little bit before they feel comfortable enough to make that change. And again, other ungulates going through the same thing. The genus Tragolaphus has gone through a similar revision back and forth between one and two species of, what is it, bushbuck?
The bushbucks, yes, yeah. Absolutely. The morphology, so it reaches out and grabs you. There are very big differences over there. So that is one that I definitely can see being split in the future. Yeah.
And then there are some groups of mammal that I still see that there's going to be continued revision in, like primates. Whether you believe the primatologists on how many species they recognize or not, there's a bunch going on, especially in the neotropics in Madagascar right now, or that have gone on in the neotropics in Madagascar. And there's continual work that needs to be done in Africa and Asia to really understand the diversity of species that exist in that group there. But rodents, Eulipitiflins, bats, I think they're going to continue to have these huge taxonomic fluxes. We're at an age where molecular data has been thrown at all of these groups now, and we're still discovering new individuals, new populations across the distributions of these different species and in areas we haven't explored well enough, like the Amazon, the Congo, and the Saholian region or Melanesia. And as we find more populations and throw more genetic data at this, utilize whole genomes, more species are going to be discovered, especially in these very mega diverse groups of small mammals. But again, ungulates, I definitely see that's a group that needs a lot of revision, but is very hard to revise because the conservation implications of collecting specimens, how difficult it is to collect specimens in general, and the fact that a lot of the collecting for this group has been done very far back in time, back in the early 1800s, early 1900s, and very little recently. So if you want to do historical sampling of genetic data, that's great. You definitely do that, but you're not going to have a lot of data to work with compared to if you use modern specimens.
So moving away from taxonomy, we talk about taxonomy being an imperfect science, but equally creating accurate distribution maps for a species can be very challenging. And you have helped create distribution maps for the latest Lynx books. So what information do you use to create those maps, and where does it actually come from?
There are a few different sources of information. Most of it comes from museum collections, especially for groups that are not as well known. So, for example, a lot of the rodent species in North America, we may not have them well identified for individual records of like just people finding them, but we have museum samples that are well identified based on curators and people who actually study this group. So a lot of the stuff is based, a lot of the distribution maps in the Handbook of the Mammals of the World, the Illustrated Checklist of the Mammals of the World, and the All Mammals of the World volumes that Lynx Editions, or Lynx Nature Books, now Lynx Nature Books, has put out are based primarily on these museum specimens. However, for groups that are better known or better identifiable by the general public, we also like to use iNaturalist records. And iNaturalist records are a good source for species that may not be easily collected for museums, such as, for, I don't know, porcupines. Porcupines are really difficult to collect. They may not be collected at all points in their distribution. Unlike small mammals, which we set traps out very easily and can very easily process those into a museum collection and be archived in places like the Arctos database, which stores museum specimen data for a bunch of museums across the Americas. But iNaturalist is a good source for those and other large mammals. For more accurate current distributions for species that may have shifting distributions, we want to be careful to look at when those records were found, if modern surveys have been conducted in certain areas. So like the puma, for example, we are not going to put the eastern United States as part of its distribution, even though we have museum records from that species throughout those areas. But we know today, based on surveys, that they're only found in southern Florida consistently, although I've heard of records of the species throughout the South as well. But it's not consistent. It's not well known. And we don't know if there's breeding populations there. And for some groups, it's better to put where breeding populations are rather than where they could potentially fully be. That happens a lot with large herbivores and carnivores, where we know that they're breeding in this area, but there's been scattered records throughout this. Like for example, moose have been recorded as far south as New Mexico, but we don't include New Mexico as this distribution because it's not a consistently habitated area. It's all based on what is available in the literature at that time. And what we have in museum collections is important for species that we don't know a lot about, but species we do know a lot about, we can use more publications or modern publications to look at their current distribution.
But again, it's interesting just how much decision-making actually needs to go into this process. If you have one vagrant bear, for instance, that moves all across, let's say, four southern states, does that mean that those four southern states are now included in that bear range, et cetera, or not? So there are so many elements that go into actually creating a good distribution map. And in fact, I think the best distribution maps that I've seen tend to be split into the core ranges and sort of vagrant ranges and then the historical record ranges, etc. And it's a bit hard to do that on a small map for many, many species, but when people are doing action plans for just one or two species, that's typically what they tend to do.
Yeah, and the species that we generally have that kind of data for, they tend to be marine mammals and carnivores, sometimes ungulates, and bats occasionally too. because bats, they usually associate with roosts, and you can track those roosts. And if you know where those roosts are, where their migrations patterns are, you can kind of figure out what individuals might be vagrants to a specific area or whether they have breeding populations. But especially as we go towards the tropical areas of the world, we don't have that kind of data unless it's a very, very charismatic species such as rhinos or jaguars. But for small mammals, that's not even, we cannot come close to that. We just base it off of the couple museum specimens we might have. Like there are some species that we only have a single record from the 1800s for, which is always really sad, like the Togo mouse, Leiomyces butneri. That species, I know some people that are trying to go find it, still haven't successfully found it. And we don't know if it's even, it could have been a vagrant there. Who knows? Well, those two specimens that we have from the 1890s could have been vagrants. So,
or mislabeled. That's the other rabbit hole that we won't get into.
So fun.
Yeah.
You've talked already about the importance of things like iNaturalist and citizen science to help with this in a limited way. Is there anything mammal watchers, the mammal watching community, can do to help? Do you think can help with this, you know, taxonomy and ranges?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that they can do. iNaturalist is obviously the first kind of easy place that a lot of people can catalog their records of specific species. But for mammals especially, this can be really difficult for small mammals like shrews and rodents, where there's a lot of cryptic variation and the species overlap and distribution. It might be hard to like snap a picture and be like, oh, I found this dead rodent. Who knows what it is? I think it's a rhytho. But something that you can do with that is contact local museums, send those pictures there, and they might be able to help you identify it before you put it on iNaturalist, which for these small mammals is really critical, especially when iNaturalist, it funnels a lot of its records into GBIF. GBIF stands for Global Biodiversity Information Facility. And GBIF is used at, GBIF records are used in a lot of research studies. So I've used GBIF to do ecological niche modeling, or I will be for my own project. And part of those records that exist for these species are museum based, and the other part are iNaturalist records that have been cataloged and put into GBIF. But making sure those identities are correct is really important for all sorts of downstream applications of these records. So if there's anyone that is more of a novice in the mammal watching community, sending these pictures to people who may know what these organisms are a little better would be a good first step. On top of that, there are plenty of ways you can also reach out to the scientific community and try to help. I know Roland Kays, he's been doing a lot of citizen science work with camera trap footage. And he's elected a lot of people to go and put camera traps in various places throughout the country. And that data gets compiled and used for all sorts of research-based applications, including distribution for a lot of these larger mammals that we may not know the full scope of their distribution at this point, given that these animals go much further, they distribute much further than smaller mammals.
One of the things that some people, namely John, has been doing, has been providing the American Society of Mammalogists with his mammal photos. And they now have a fairly robust library of photos of mammals from around the world. So is this something that you would also encourage other mammal watchers to do? And if so, how does one go about that? And how would you find out what species the ASM would actually need?
Honestly, send them everything. Okay. I would absolutely recommend that. The key to it, though, is making sure that you know what your species is. The person who is in charge of it currently is David Huckabee. He's also part of our crew at the MDD. He provides a lot of insights and corrections to the taxonomy and distribution of a lot of species, because he has to know a lot about that, because he also has to ID these animals, and he matches the mammal image library to the MDD as we make changes. So it can be a hassle to keep up with those identity changes, especially for groups that are more cryptic and where you might not necessarily know where the picture was taken. But the mammal image library is a really great resource, in the sense that it provides photos of mammals that are well identified and usually georeferenced with regards to where their photo was taken. I would highly recommend sending more pictures to them, especially if you think you have some rare species. I think we have over 1,000 species currently represented on there, and most genera at this point, at least within North America. But I'd have to talk to David a little bit more. He's a great resource as well for any questions related to the Mammal Image Library, and I'd highly recommend sending more pictures their way.
Yeah, he takes his job very seriously, so it's quite a lot of work. I mean, he's perpetually, I send him, all I do is dump images into Google Drive from a trip report, and then he meticulously checks them all, makes, you know, a spreadsheet of where they were seen and works out all the errors I've got, because my camera's always set at the wrong date and time and tries to figure it out. So I'm not sure he wants every picture, but definitely the rarest stuff. And I know he follows the site, but I'll talk to him. But I think, them, you know, a lot of people have got images, they don't put them in trip reports. I'm thinking of people like Carlos, if you're listening, all your Indonesian stuff, all those things I think would be absolute gold for the ASM. So yeah, I encourage people to do that, but I'll talk to David and we'll figure out a system for how he can do that.
And we won't mention this to David, but the very first photo of a mammal that I looked at under the ASM library was incorrectly identified. So,
well, no, it wasn't one of mine, was it?
It wasn't one of yours, John. No, I won't take this any further, lest I be banished. but I will slip. I will slip David a little message just to inform him. And it wasn't one of his photos either.
So, Connor, I mean, you've talked about your passions for listing, and I know you've done some field, but would you call yourself a mammal watcher?
I would, in the sense that I do like watching mammals, but I haven't been a huge member of the community, even though I wish that I had been, especially when I was younger. I want to be more of a member of the community. I want to take photos. I'm kind of strapped for cash, so it's not like I get to go out and like see the world of mammals very easily, and I don't have a nice camera to take photos of them. I have my own impromptu life list for mammals that is based on the MDD, obviously. And getting up there, you know, finding mammal after mammal. But yeah, I'd like to be more of a member of the mammal watching community.
Well, okay, so what's one of your highlights be? Yeah. Come on, Connor, let's hear it.
So my favorite mammal that I've, there's two. So one of them was when I was in Ecuador and we were staying in Yasuni National Park. And we were at a research station with some botanists, and we had some students that we were doing research with down that area. But there was this one tapir that was a released individual. So it was a female that had been rescued from the wild, rehabilitated, and sent back in to this area in Yosemite National Park. But it liked to come through the reserve where everyone was at. And everyone would feed it, which is not great. However, it was one of the most amazing experiences to see a tapir in the wild. I can't remember which species lives in the Amazon now.
Lowland tapir. Yeah.
Yeah, lowland tapir. And yeah, that was one of the most amazing experiences, because secretly I got to pet it, and that was insane. And then the other one that's pretty crazy is when I was hiking in central Idaho one time, and this is one that a lot of people get to see, but I feel like I had a weirdly intimate interaction with them. I was about 19 or 20, working in the field ecology lab, And I was just kind of skipping ahead of this group of people. And I walk around a corner and there is a mountain lion walking straight at me on the same on the same
Wow.
trail. I spook, it spooks. I'm terrified. I don't know what to do. But it just stared at me. And that was one of the scariest things, because I was like, I spooked this. I was being loud. I was making sure that I would not like sneak up on any of these animals, but I snuck up on an accident. And then the rest of my group came around the corner and it started. So that was a pretty, pretty crazy experience. And that's one of my favorite mammal interactions.
I bet that I've sounds had. Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what would be, would you have like a top three you'd love to see for taxonomic or other reasons in the wild?
Oh, that is like choosing a favorite child.
Well, that's easy.
I like my daughter. Yeah, I do that all the time. Yeah.
Joking,
it normally changes day by day, but still.
Well, I've only got one kid, so it's not like right. It's hard for me. I think probably the top three would be one of the Philippine cloud rats.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. That would be absolutely in the top three. Do you guys know the visored bat, Saranicarus?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in my top 10 as well as the cloud rat. So
oh,
we're on the same
God.
Page. Yeah.
I want to see one of those so, so bad.
I'll talk
They're
to you
the
about that later.
Looking things.
Yeah, aren't they? Yeah.
They're found in Colombia, right? Like
well, they are, I think, but Venezuela on those weird kind of those hill
yeah.
things they have there might be the place to find them, I think.
Yeah, yeah, no, that I want to go there so bad. I want to find one. And yeah. then if I were to try to choose another one, it'd probably be a hog badger, honestly.
Yeah.
Like just a very random species, not like the most memorable, but they're a group that like when I was younger, I saw a revision of that genus and I was like, the hog badger? Arctonyx? What mm-hmm. the heck is this? So it's always been a species in the back of my mind that I've always wanted to see. But the funny thing is I want to do research ultimately in New Guinea and other parts of Indonesia throughout my career. So there's a lot of stuff I want to see throughout there, which I didn't list like any from that region except the cloud rat. So
yeah, right, right. Oh, wow. I have to admit that that's choices. Perhaps the most eclectic top three list I've ever heard. but sounds wonderful. And
I know exactly where you're coming from with those three. And I'm going to talk to you later about the visored bat because I'm really keen to take a trip to try and figure that out. And I have a Venezuelan contact
ooh.
Who I'm not sure she knows much about the bats, but she can get us into the right place, I think. So, yeah. Stay
okay.
tuned.
Let's talk about that more.
So, Connor, thank you so much. This has been absolutely fascinating. I have to admit, I just love the idea that your childhood mammal list basically becomes the go-to list for all biologists now, and that you made that happen. So that is, it's just such a wonderful story. So thank you for telling us about what you do and running us through all the various permutations of listing. And I do want to also point out that it was thanks to Rob Jansen that we actually got you on board. He actually wrote to us and said, look, you know, this guy called Connor is doing this great work and you really should interview him for the podcast. So thank you, Rob. But best of luck to you, Connor. And I really do hope that you get to see your cloud rats and visored bat.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on here. And also thanks to Rob, because I wouldn't have gone on here.
Thank you from me, especially for the work you do on the MDD. As I say, it's a really great resource. And I just try to push it to everyone. It's fantastic. So it's catching on. And a big, big help with, you know, links taking on board as well through you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for coming on. It's great to put a face to the MDD. And of course, with great power comes great responsibility, but it seems like you're just the man for that job. So use your power wisely and keep my, don't take too many species off my list.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.